Welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and I'm so pleased to have you join me in our weekly treasure hunt of titles that keep you turning those pages. This week, since it is the new year, and everyone's resolution numero uno is getting active and getting into shape, I propose we do some genre jumping. We'll look, rather we'll listen, to books topping the charts in genres as diverse as thrillers, histories, family dramas, and humor. Speaking of humor, I'm not making this up. We have as one of our guests today the one and only Dave Barry. So let's exercise our options to get started.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well-represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. M-A-G-I-C-B-U-Z.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
Dead or Alive brings together, for the first time, an all-star cast of Tom Clancy's greatest characters in a joint showdown with global terrorists. This new Clancy title shares authorship with Grant Blackwood. Jack Ryan, the former president of the United States, is out of office, but not out of the loop concerning his brainchild, The Campus, a highly effective counterterrorism organization operating outside the Washington hierarchy. But what Ryan doesn't know is that his son, Jack Jr., has joined his cousins, Brian and Dominic Caruso, at the shadowy campus. While a highly effective analyst, young Ryan hungers for the action of a field agent. The campus turns their sight on the Emir, the number one terrorist threat to Western civilization. A reclusive figure and mastermind of vicious terrorism, the Emir has eluded capture by the world's law enforcement agencies. But now, with the help of ex-CIA agent John Clark and protege Marine Colonel Ding Chavez, the campus is on the hunt. In a fast-paced, intense performance, actor Lou Diamond Phillips narrates the story of their mission to bring in the Emir, dead or alive.
Lines on maps didn't make borders, Driscoll knew, especially in Indian country like this. He'd check his GPS equipment to be sure of his position, but latitude and longitude really didn't matter to his mission. What mattered was where they were headed, regardless of where it fell on the map. The local population knew little about borders, and didn't especially care. For them, reality was which tribe you were in, which family you were a part of, and which flavor of Muslim you were. Here, memories lasted 100 years, and the stories even longer, and grudges even longer than that. The locals still boasted that their ancestors had driven Alexander the Great out of the country, and some of them still remember the names of the warriors who had bested the Macedonian spearmen, who had, up until then, conquered every other place they'd wandered into. Most of all, though, the locals spoke of the Russians, and how many of those they'd killed, mostly by ambush, some with knives, face to face. They smiled and laughed with those stories, legends passed on from father to son. Driscoll doubted the Russian soldiers who made it out of Afghanistan did much laughing about the experience. No, sir. These were not nice folks, he knew. They were scary tough, hardened by weather, war, famine, and just generally trying to stay alive in a country that seemed to be doing its best to kill you most of the time. Driscoll knew he ought to feel some sympathy for them. God had just dealt them a bad hand, and maybe that wasn't their fault. But it wasn't Driscoll's fault either. Nor his concern. They were enemies of Driscoll's country, and the powers that be had pointed the stick at them and ordered go, and so here they were. That was the central truth of the moment, the reason he was in these goddamn mountains. One more ridge was the other central truth, especially here, it seemed. They'd legged it 15 clicks, almost all of it uphill, and over sharp rock and scree since they'd hopped off the CH-47 Chinook helicopter, a Delta variant, the only one at their disposal that could handle the altitude here. There. The ridgeline. 50 meters. Driscoll slowed his pace. He was walking point, leading the patrol as the senior NCO present, with his men stretched out 100 meters to his rear, alert, eyes sweeping left and right, up and down, M4 carbines at ready low and trained at their sectors. They expected there to be a few sentries on the ridgeline. The locals might be uneducated in the traditional sense, but they weren't stupid by any measure, which was why the Rangers were running this op at night. 0144, or 1:45 in the morning, according to his digital watch. No moon tonight, and high clouds thick enough to block whatever light came from the stars. Good hunting weather, he thought. His eyes traced more down than up. He didn't want to make any noise, and noise came from the feet. One damned rock kicked loose and rolling down the hillside could betray them all. Couldn't have that, could he? Couldn't waste the 3 days and 15 miles it had taken them to get this close. 20 meters to the ridgeline. 60 feet. His eyes searched the line for movement. Nothing close. A few more steps, looking left and right, his noise-suppressed carbine cradled to his chest at ready low, finger resting lightly on the trigger, just enough to know it was there. It was hard to explain to people how hard this was, how tiring and debilitating, far more so than a 15-mile hike in the woods. Knowing there might be someone with an AK-47 in his hands and his finger on a trigger.
Newt Gingrich and William R. Forsten put the focus on our forefather, George Washington, in Valley Forge. It's the winter of 1777, and Washington's battered, demoralized army retreats from Philadelphia. Arriving at Valley Forge, they find their repeated requests for food, winter clothing, and building tools have been ignored by Congress. With no other options available, the men settle down for a season of agony. For weeks, the dwindling army lives under tents out in the bitter cold. Food runs out. The men are on the point of collapse, while in Philadelphia, the British live in luxury. In spite of the suffering and deceit, Washington endures all, joined at last by a volunteer from Germany, Baron von Steuben. Von Steuben begins the hard task of recasting the army as a professional fighting force, capable of facing the British head-on. In the process, the course of history will be changed forever. Valley Forge is a tour de force about endurance, transformation, and rebirth. You don't need to be a Revolutionary War enthusiast to love this book. It's read by William DeFries and Callista Gingrich.
General Washington's courage in deciding to gamble everything was one of the most important building blocks of America. Without Washington's courage in crossing the river at night and marching 9 miles in a blinding snowstorm, the American Revolution might well have collapsed at the end of 1776. Without the courage of the men who served in the army, Washington's courage would have been to no avail. By himself, George Washington could not have created a free country. But as a leader with thousands of dedicated followers, he had a chance. Over the last year, audience after audience has responded emotionally to the story of a small group of dedicated patriots changing the course of history by their devotion, their dedication, and their endurance. When audiences learn that fewer than 1 out of every 1,000 Americans was with Washington during that desperate time, they are amazed. Even more, they learn that 1/3 of the 2,500 men who crossed the Delaware at night on an icy river during a blinding snowstorm had no shoes, they are astounded. When they learn that these men left a trail of blood on the icy, stony road to Trenton, they have tears in their eyes. For all of our complaints and all of our problems, This is the cost of freedom. And this is the courage, determination, and patient persistence that made America a free country. Washington's great victory at Trenton was followed by another great victory at Princeton 2 weeks later. Then he drove the British from most of New Jersey back toward New York City and their naval base. After that exciting winter campaign, most Americans believed they were on the edge of winning the Revolution. Freedom seemed to be at their fingertips. Yet the greatest empire in the world was far from done with its efforts to reconquer the Americans. After all, the British Empire had put down rebellions in Ireland and Scotland, and peasant uprisings in rural England. Such policing was just a necessary part of running an empire. Throughout 1777, Washington found himself on the defensive, and when the British used their command of the sea to move the army from New York City to Philadelphia, he found that his undertrained army was incapable of staying in the field against British and German professional soldiers. At Brandywine and Germantown, the Americans came tantalizingly close to winning, and then fell apart. The sheer discipline and routine competence of British and German professionals outlasted the enthusiasm and energy of the American amateurs. At Paoli, an American unit was surprised at night, and, at least in the American view, many of its men were massacred by British troops using bayonets. While Washington was fighting a frustrating series of losing battles, the one glorious bright spot was in the North, where General Gates was winning. Gates was born in England and had served in the British Army, but he had lived in America for a long time. He saw himself as a professional soldier and had contempt for Washington, whom he saw as an incompetent amateur in over his head. Washington sent forces to help Gates contain General John Burgoyne at Saratoga in the fall of 1777 and then force his surrender. This was an extraordinary moment of optimism. An entire British army surrendered. It proved to be the key event in convincing the French to enter into an alliance with the Americans. Every American was impressed with this great victory, and it contrasted vividly with Washington's failure to win in New Jersey and Pennsylvania. Washington loyalists knew that General Washington had generously sent some of his best troops to help Gates. They also knew that at the key moment in the campaign, Benedict Arnold had provided leadership when Gates faltered. Finally, they knew that Washington had kept the vast bulk of the British Army facing him instead of marching north to rescue Burgoyne.
Allison Liotta has been a federal sex crimes prosecutor in Washington for the past 10 years. Like her heroine in Law of Attraction, Allison started out in the U.S. Attorney's Office prosecuting misdemeanor domestic violence cases. She now handles the most serious sex crimes in D.C. Allison is a grad of Michigan State University and Harvard Law. Her husband is also a federal prosecutor. Allison has made legal history herself. As a young prosecutor, she petitioned a D.C. Superior Court to let an assault victim statement to a police officer be admitted as evidence when the victim would not testify against her boyfriend at trial. Liotta's legal creative streak has served her well in her novel. Welcome, Allison. So great to have you with us today.
Hi, Elaine. Thank you so much for having me.
What really impressed me is how quickly a reader gets drawn into your book. Your writing is that good. Obviously,
you
write what you know. So how much of your main character, Anna Curtis, is based on your early experience as a rookie prosecutor in D.C.?
She goes through a lot of the same frustrations, a lot of the same challenges. Some of the crazy things that happened to me happened to her. And she has some similar reactions to that. So that was a lot of fun to have this woman go through what I went through when I was a little bit younger. But she's a little bit different than me, too. She comes from a much darker family. She had a much more violent childhood, and that makes her take her work a lot more personally than I do. I tend to be a little more analytical about things, but Anna takes it to heart.
How long did you have this book in your head before you started writing?
I think throughout the time that I was doing my job, I'm a sex crimes prosecutor, things would happen every day, astonishing things. You know, you just never know what was around the corner. And every time they would happen, I would think, someone really needs to write a book about this. And then finally one day I just thought, all right, well, put your money where your mouth is, and why don't you go ahead and write the book?
So from when you started writing to, you know, when the book went off to print, how long was that process?
That took 2 years. I was working my full-time job the whole time. I was working as a sex crimes prosecutor in D.C., and I would write for 2 hours in the morning before I went to work. I'd get up at 5 a.m. and write till 7 a.m. And, you know, working at that pace, it took a little longer than I expected. But after 2 years, it was ready to go.
Wow. And I know I read in the Washington Post that you're also a marathoner. So how do you fit it all in?
I haven't been a marathoner actually in a long time. The exercise I get these days is chasing my little boys. I have a 3-year-old and a 1-year-old. So there isn't that much time for marathoning anymore. But I don't know. I think, every working mom tries to juggle and balance, and we all find some way to do it. I think it helped when I just turned off the TV. You know, it's so tempting to just, you know, sit back and relax and let your mind wander and watch these fun shows. But I found that if I took those couple of hours that I was spending at night watching TV and use them instead to try to come up with my own story, in the long run, I could create something out of that time.
And are you currently working as a prosecutor right now, or did you take some time off to promote the book? Or
I am still at the U.S. Attorney's Office, although they were very nice and gave me a sabbatical. So I'm officially off right now. This is my house, and this is where I've been writing and working on my next book. I actually just signed a deal with Simon & Schuster to write 2 more sequels to Law of Attraction. So that's what I'm working on now.
And who is your favorite legal thriller writer? Or when you read for pleasure, you do a totally different genre. What's your fave?
I actually read voraciously. I've always been a big reader, which I think is part of what made me want to take a shot at writing. For legal thrillers, I think Scott Turow is just the master. He's great. I'm also a big fan of Linda Fairstein and Lisa Scottolini. They do. Scottolini just does a great chick lit legal thriller, and Linda Fairstein was a prosecutor, also the head of the sex crimes unit in Manhattan, so she knows what she's talking about. I really like that.
Well, I think Law of Attraction would make a great movie. Are there any plans?
Thanks. That would be fabulous. No, there aren't plans, but there have been some nibbles, and my agent's dealing with that, and I'll just keep my fingers crossed for that.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Allison, and I loved your book.
Thank you. It's so great to hear that. I really appreciate that.
Readers, you will too. Pick it up. Law of Attraction. Thanks, Allison.
Thanks. Take care.
Okay.
As a newly minted assistant U.S. attorney, rookie lawyer Anna Curtis faces a daily stack of domestic violence cases. Yet when victim LaPrea Johnson's case makes its way to her desk, Anna discovers a case she will take very personally. From the back room of the U.S. Attorney's Office with its Ivy League lawyers to the struggles of its poorest citizens in gritty Anacostia, Law of Attraction is a gripping debut novel. Tavia Gilbert narrates.
The courthouse coffee was terrible. But the morning after Valentine's Day was no time for a domestic violence prosecutor to go uncaffeinated. Anna poured the inky brew into a styrofoam cup, took a sip, and grimaced. Scalding and bitter. A fitting start to a day of sorting through last night's crimes. At least she'd have help. Anna pulled out her cell phone and called her office mate. DV papering, Grace answered in crisp sing-song. Hey, it's Anna. I'm in the cafeteria. Want some coffee? That'd be fabulous. Grace hushed her voice. And grab a bunch of napkins. There's a woman bleeding all over your chair. Grace had been a prosecutor for 4 months, but Anna was still new enough that the information jolted her. Should we call an ambulance? She's okay. A lot of scrapes and bruises and a very messy nosebleed. Nothing life-threatening. I can cover till you get here. And can you snag me a muffin? I'm starving. Sure, be right there. Marveling at Grace's calm, Anna grabbed a muffin and got in line to pay. 3 people stood in front of her, a tall guy in a dark suit, a man wearing a Redskins jersey over a blue-collared shirt, and a buxom woman in fishnet stockings and a spandex miniskirt. Lawyer, Anna guessed of the first man. Then a policeman, hiding his uniform so courthouse visitors wouldn't ask him questions. And a prostitute, just getting off work, here to see her probation officer. The one thing Anna liked about the courthouse's grim basement cafeteria was its democracy. The cop might arrest the prostitute later tonight, and the lawyer might skewer the cop during cross-examination, but everyone had to wait in the same line to get their corned beef hash. After paying, Anna hurried to the napkin dispenser, but the tall lawyer who'd been ahead of her took the last ones. She looked at him in dismay. "Actually, I really need those," she said, nodding at the napkins in his hand. Something about the man's dark hair and lanky figure seemed familiar, but out of place. His tailored suit and buttery leather briefcase were common in the federal court next door, but marked him as several income brackets above the D.C. Superior Court crowd. He probably worked for some big Washington law firm in one of the high-paying jobs she'd turned down to work for the government. The man glanced down at her and suddenly grinned. "Anna Curtis! Hey, it's been a while." "Hi, She shook her head. "Nick Wagner. Harvard Law School. I had a ridiculous beard and hair down to here." He tapped his shoulder and blushed slightly. "Your team beat mine in the final round of Ames Moot Court. Kicked our asses, in fact."
"Nick! You used to play guitar in the Hark during Friday happy hour."
"You got it."
His smile widened.
"I guess you made more of an impression on me than I made on you."
"Sorry, I'm just in a rush and focused on those napkins." Nick placed them ceremoniously in her palm.
"Some kind of food spill emergency?"
"Thank you. Bloody nose. Abuse victim in the papering room. So I've gotta go." Anna began to walk out of the cafeteria, looking over her shoulder with regret. "I'm sorry I can't really talk now." Nick hurried along with her through the labyrinth of the courthouse basement.
"So you're a prosecutor and you pulled papering duty on the day after Valentine's Day? What'd you do, run over the U.S. attorney's dog?"
She had to laugh. Papering was the most despised assignment in the U.S. attorney's office, a task only the greenest prosecutors could be compelled to do. Anna would turn arrests from the last 24 hours into criminal case files, typing information into a computer, two-hole-punching police paperwork, condensing lifetimes of violence into slim manila folders. The tedium was broken only when a victim came to tell her sad story in person. And Valentine's Day was notoriously the worst time for domestic violence. People were two-timing each other, or paying too much attention to their baby's mother and not enough to their wife, or just plain forgetting a card. It was surprising how often a lover's quarrel turned into a trip to lockup.
Best-selling author Anna Quinlan creates an unforgettable portrait of a mother, a father, a family, and the explosive, violent consequences of what had seemed like an inconsequential act. In every last one, Mary Beth Latham is first and foremost a mother, one whose three teenagers come first before her career as a gardener or even her life as the wife of a doctor. Caring for her family and preserving their everyday life is paramount. And so, when one of her sons becomes depressed, Mary Beth focuses on him and is blindsided by a shocking act of violence. What happens afterwards is a testament to the power of a woman's love and determination, and to the invisible line of hope and healing that connects one human being with another. In the hands of Anna Quinlan, Every Last One is a novel about facing every last one of the things we fear most, and about finding ways to navigate a road we never intended to travel. It's read by Hope Davis.
At 6:30, I hear the shower come on in the master bath. Glenn is awake and getting ready for work. At 6:45, I pull the duvet off Ruby, who snatches it back and curls herself into it, larval, and says, 10 more minutes. At 7, I lean over, first Alex, then Max, and bury my nose into their necks, beginning to smell the slightly pungent scent of male beneath the sweetness of child. Okay, okay, Alex says irritably. Max says nothing, just lurches from bed and begins to pull off an oversized t-shirt as he stumbles into the bathroom. There's a line painted down the center of their room. 2 years ago, they came to me at a loose end on a June afternoon and demanded the right to choose their own colors. I was distracted, and I agreed. They did a neat job, measured carefully, put a tarp on the floor. Alex painted his side light blue, Max lime green. The other mothers say, "You won't believe what Jonathan or Andrew or Peter told me about the twins' room." Maybe if the boys had been my first children, I would have thought it was insane too, but Ruby broke me in. She has a tower of soda cans against one wall of her bedroom. It is either an environmental statement or just one of those things you do when you are 15. Now that she is 17, she has outgrown it, almost forgotten it. But because I made the mistake of asking early on when she would take it down, she never has. I open Ruby's door, and although it doesn't make a sound, she has oiled the hinges, I think. Probably with baby oil or bath oil or something else nonsensically inappropriate, so we will not hear it creak in the nighttime. She says, "I'm up." I stand there waiting because if I take her word for it, she will wrap herself in warmth again and fall into the long tunnel of sleep that only teenagers inhabit, halfway to coma or unconsciousness. "Mom, I'm up," she shouts, and throws the bedclothes aside and begins to bundle her long wavy hair atop her head. "Can I get dressed in peace, please, for a change?" She makes it sound as though I constantly let a bleacher full of spectators gawk as she prepares to meet the day. Only Glenn emerges in the least bit cheerful, his suit jacket over one arm. He keeps his white coats at the office. They are professionally cleaned and pressed and smell lovely, like the cleanest of clean laundry. "Dr. Latham" is embroidered in blue script above his heart. From upstairs, I can hear the clatter of the cereal into his bowl. He eats the same thing every morning, leaves for work at the same time. He wears either a blue or a yellow shirt with either a striped tie or one with a small repeating pattern. Occasionally, a grateful patient gives him a tie as a gift, printed with tiny pairs of glasses, an eye chart, or even eyes themselves. He thanks these people sincerely, but never wears them. He is not tidy, but he knows where everything is, on which chair he left his briefcase, in what area of the kitchen counter he tossed his wallet. He does something with the corners of his mouth when things are not as they should be. When the dog is on the furniture, when the children and their friends make too much noise too late at night, when the red wine glasses are in the white wine glass rack. It has now pressed itself permanently into his expression, like the opposite of dimples. "Please spare me," says my friend Nancy, her eyes rolling. "If that's the worst you can say about him, then you have absolutely no right to complain." Nancy says her husband, Bill, a tall, gangly scarecrow of a guy, leaves a trail of clothing as he undresses, like fairy tale breadcrumbs. He once asked her where the washing machine was.
In The Lonely Polygamist, Brady Udall pens a tragic comic tale starring Golden Richards, who, despite having four wives and 28 children, hasn't quite found fulfillment in life. Like other men in the midst of a midlife crisis, Golden feels as though he's drowning. His wives squabble among themselves, and he hardly has time for all the children, least of all the 11-year-old who seems to have a keen interest in explosives. Yet even after Golden falls in love again and takes an outsider mistress to alleviate his pain, life continues to fall short of expectations. Udall's skillfully observed tale is as comic as it is sublimely catastrophic. Here is David Aaron Baker narrating.
He limped up to the front door, a feeling of doom settling on the back of his neck. His leg tingled painfully, and he could feel the noise of the house and the vibration of the boards beneath his feet. A hand-lettered sign next to the front door commanded, "Wipe your feet," and Golden obediently scuffed the soles of his boots on the rubber welcome mat. He took a few deep, motivational nose breaths, put his hand on the doorknob, but couldn't find the will to give it a turn. There was no getting around it. He was afraid. Afraid that, finally, the truth had been discovered, that he had been exposed as a sneak, a cheat, a liar. Look at him, a man afraid to walk into his own house. Once he thumbed his shirt tail into his pants, knocked some of the sawdust out of his hair, dug a breath mint from his shirt pocket, and taken a couple toots of Afrin nasal spray, he felt a bit more sure of himself. He put his hand back on the doorknob and closed his eyes. "Come on," he whispered. "Come on, you sissy." Like a man gathering to jump into an icy pond, he pushed open the door. A wave of heat hit him. The house was as hot as a bakery. The tiled entry was dim and empty, and the rich, sugary smell of something in the oven. Hopefully, Beverly's pineapple upside-down cake made his mouth water. He took one stealthy heel-to-toe step, another, stopped to listen. Over the sounds of hollering and pounding feet, he could hear the radio and the sound of water chuckling through overhead pipes. Normally, there would have been a crush of children waiting at the door, all of them shouting at once, pulling at his clothes and asking him what he'd brought them, the little ones standing on their heads or displaying some new bruise or scab. "Look at me! Look at me!" And the wives hanging back, waiting for their chance to lay their claims on him, each one of them a burning spotlight of attention and need. But for the first time in his memory, there was no one there to greet him. He was all alone, and it unnerved him. He listened, trying to get a sense of what he might be facing. A door slammed. Muffled voices echoed down the stairway. He willed himself to step forward, out of the dark hallway and into the light of the family room, but Golden kept imagining, slipping back out the door, skulking away like a burglar, maybe heading out to the highway to get a room at the Apache Acres Motor Inn, where he could take a long, serious leak, call home to claim engine trouble, and then order some of that good country fried steak from the all-night diner and watch Starsky and Hutch on a color television. But his little fantasy didn't last long because at that moment, the children attacked. Somebody yelled, "Kill the zombie!" And he was grabbed from behind by his belt, from both sides around the calves. They came from behind the couches and on top of the stairs, 10, 12 of them, ramming him with their small heads, clawing at his legs, hooking their fingers in the pockets of his jeans, trying to drag him down. Herschel, Fig Newton, Ferris, Darling, J-Mo, Louise, Teague. There were the second twins, Sybil and Deanne, and the three stooges, yipping like mariachis. They were all sweaty and wild, and for a moment, it felt like the sheer weight of them might tear him apart. On another night, Golden might have gone along, moaning like a cartoon mummy, flailing his arms in mock undead rage, falling with them onto the carpet of the living room floor, wrestling and tickling and kissing. But not tonight. No way. He locked his knees and went stiff, hoping to outlast them. But they hung on, screaming with laughter, egging each other on. 11-year-old Rusty, who was, as his mother called him, hefty, and getting too old for this kind of thing, slipped from his hiding place behind the curtains and leapt off the piano bench onto Golden's back, nearly bringing the whole pile down.
For more than 25 years, Dave Barry has been a syndicated columnist whose work appears in more than 500 newspapers across the country and around the world. In 1988, he won the Pulitzer Prize for commentary. Dave grew up in Armonk, New York, and was elected class clown at Pleasantville High. He earned a BA in English from Haverford College. Dave began his journalism career in 1971, working as a general assignment reporter for the Daily Local News in Westchester, Pennsylvania. He also started a weekly humor column for that paper. He worked briefly as a copy editor for the Associated Press before joining a consulting firm where he attempted to teach effective writing to business people. In his own words, he spent nearly 8 years trying to get various business persons to stop writing things like, "Enclosed, please find the enclosed enclosures." In 1981, Dave wrote a humorous guest column in the Philadelphia Inquirer, which attracted the attention of Gene Weingarten, then an editor at Tropic, the Miami Herald Sunday magazine. In 1983, Barry was hired by Weingarten as a humor columnist, and the rest, as they say, is history. Dave has written 35 books, two of which were used as the basis for the 90s TV sitcom Dave's World. Dave's first novel, Big Trouble, was made into a movie starring Tim Allen and Rene Russo. Dave plays lead guitar in a literary rock band called the Rock Bottom Remainders, whose other members have included Stephen King, Amy Tan, Ridley Pearson, and Mitch Albom. The boss, Bruce Springsteen, has even joined in for a set or two. Dave has also made numerous TV appearances, including one on The David Letterman Show, where he proved it is possible to set fire to a pair of men's underpants with a Barbie doll. In his spare time, Dave is a candidate for President of the United States. Welcome, Dave.
Thank you, Elaine. It's good to be here.
Well, I want to start this interview by saying, especially to my female listeners, you must read Dave's latest, I'll Mature When I'm Dead, because in it, the renowned author, Mr. Barry, unlocks the secret that has plagued women for centuries. The answer to why men never ask for directions. Dave, can you share the secret now with our radio audience?
Well, first of all, I thought you were going to say that you're excited for your female listeners because I'm so incredibly attractive, but okay.
You are.
I'll if it's radio, so. There are a lot of things women wonder about men that I talk about in the book. And of course, the directions thing, I mean, that's been going on forever and ever. Women make fun of us because we don't ask directions. And we know that women find that amusing. But there's a simple fact. There's a reason for that, which is that if we exhibit that weakness let's say we don't know where we're trying to get to. We don't know how to get to our destination. And there's a woman in the car next to us. And we pull over to the side of the road and we ask another man. And he does know how to reach that destination. He can take our woman. He can just reach over and grab her. Okay, so we're protecting you, and you're laughing at us. Thanks a lot. We're trying to be strong. We're trying to protect is what we're doing.
Hmm. Well, thank you for that. Okay,
that's why I'm here. I'm here to help. I'm here to clear this up.
Well, here's something else you can clear up. In one of the chapters, you described your wheel-o toy from childhood consisting of, to quote, a red wheel and wire frame. For hours of fun and frolic, kids roll the wheels up and down and down and up. Question. Today's kids have these supremely intricate multi-level 3D computer games. Which, in your opinion, is the superior choice for positive child development?
That's a tough one. I mean, yeah, I wrote a chapter in there about technology, and I was trying to point out that when I was born, back right around the time of the American Civil War, it was considered magnetism was considered very exciting. I think it had just been discovered when I was a kid. And so, like, that was the key to the wheel-o toy, and a lot of the other toys we had was, you know, basically it was a magnet, and the wheel was attached to the wire by a magnet, and that could provide us with literally seconds of entertainment, making the wheel go up. And then we would go out and throw rocks at each other, because I think rocks was probably our main source of entertainment. And when I was a youth, yeah, and you're right, kids today. These kids today, they have their iPads and their Nintendos and their Wiis and this extremely sophisticated stuff, does all kinds of stuff. And the question, I guess, is which is better? And here's my answer to that. My generation, we grew up with Wheel-Os and Etch-a-Sketch and the Slinky. The Slinky was another toy we had that it was theoretically very exciting, at least in the commercials, when it would go down the stairs by itself. In actual real life, Slinkies don't do that. Slinkies fall over on their sides and die like some kind of sick snake. But that was what we had. And we played with those things, and then we threw rocks at each other. And look what we accomplished, my generation. We got through the Great Depression. We won World War II. No, wait, actually, now that I think of it, That wasn't my generation. That was my parents' generation. But we, we had junior year abroad. That was no picnic. We got through that. Okay, so I would say in the end, bottom line, what was the question? No, bottom line, these kids today, they don't know. I mean, with their iPods and their iPads and their why this and whatever.
In I'll Mature When I'm Dead, when writing about Father's Day, you use the term festivities. Did you coin that term? Because I loved it. And what are the other standard holidays that you consider festivities?
Oh, okay. Well, this is really a sore point. And this is an example of, you know, forever women say, men never talk about what they want. Men never say what they feel. Men never, how are we supposed to know? You know, the problem is not that men don't say what they want or what they feel. It's that women pay absolutely no attention to what men want because it's not what women really want. And Father's Day is probably the ultimate example of that. No man that I have ever met, no father, I'm a father, I know lots of fathers, not one of us likes Father's Day. We don't want Father's Day. We don't care about Father's Day. The reason we have Father's Day is because women have Mother's Day. Now, they want it. They want the festivities. They want us to give them a card. They want us to make them breakfast in bed. They want us to get all dressed up and take them out to a restaurant on Mother's Day along with every other family in North America in the same damn restaurant at the same – they want that. I don't know why, but we give them that. What we want is nothing. When you ask a man, what do you want for Father's Day? He'll say, nothing, because he doesn't want anything. He doesn't want a card. What's he supposed to do with the card? He doesn't want aftershave or cologne. He already has aftershave and cologne from the other 3,000 events that he didn't care. He doesn't want another shirt that he won't wear. He certainly doesn't want a tie. And above all, he doesn't want to go to a restaurant with every other father in North America and sit through a grim meal because it's Father's Day. He wants to lie on the sofa in his underwear and watch some kind of game involving a ball until he falls asleep. That's what he wants. And if you ask him, that's what he'll say. Will he get that? No. He's going to get what women want, festivities. So Father's Day is essentially Mother's Day for disguised as something for men. Other holidays that fall into this category are, it goes without saying, Valentine's Day. Men don't care about Valentine's Day. They never have. Really anything involving a card. Birthdays are a good example. Men don't care about birthdays. At least I know very few who do. Maybe Donald Trump. Maybe there's one or two out there who cares about birthdays. Men don't care about birthdays. They don't give each other birthday cards. No man voluntarily gives another man a card on any occasion at all, or a gift if he can avoid it. I had a discussion with my wife once. It's almost Christmas. We're driving around, and I'm saying, and we get honked at in the Miami traffic, and my wife says, I said to my wife, boy, everybody's so annoyed this time of year. What is that about? And she said, well, because everybody's tense because they have to buy cards, they have to buy gifts, they have to buy gifts. And I go, no, you don't. She goes, what do you mean? I said, you're buying all these gifts for all these women because they're going to buy gifts for you. I'm not buying gifts for anybody. Well, I have to buy you a gift because you're my wife, but that's it. And the only reason I'm doing that is because you'll get mad at me. I don't want a gift. I don't want to give anybody a gift. It's all about women inventing this stuff. Have I gone on long enough?
Wow, this is a lot to process.
back to the wheel-o. No, never mind.
No. Okay.
But that's in brief what I think about festivities and phony events.
Okay.
I could go into much more detail if you need.
You're passionate about it, I can tell.
Yeah, it's one of the few things I care about, really.
All right. You've written Dave Barry Turns 40. Dave Barry Turns 50, and I have to ask, many years in the future, will there be a Dave Barry Turns 60?
No, I did turn 60, and in a way, the book I wrote called I'll Mature When I'm Dead sort of is, you know, what I did as a result of turning 60, but not totally. I just kind of felt like that I had already, in Dave Barry Turns 40 and Dave Barry Turns 50, sort of basically said the same thing, which is, hey, I'm getting older. It's not so great. And it's, you know, that would be the same thing I'd write about turning 60. I did refer in I'll Mature When I'm Dead to some medical issues that arise as you age. I mean, the main one and sort of what led to the writing of the book in the first place was getting a colonoscopy.
Yes.
Which is, I devoted a chapter in the book that it's actually the only part of the book that ever appeared previously. It was published in the Miami Herald. And it's just because people are afraid to get colonoscopies. the reason being, and this is the reason I didn't do it, I put it off for 10 years past when I should have done it. People are afraid that in a colonoscopy, the doctor is going to take a tube and stick it 17,000 feet up your butt. And I'm here to tell you that that is exactly what happens. In fact, the big danger of the procedure is that the tube will go out of you and enter into another patient. So they have a man there with an axe to cut it off. But here's the thing, and here's really why I wanted to write about it. It's nothing, because they give you drugs. Not just any, they give you wonderful drugs, really great drugs. In fact, you don't remember anything. You don't feel anything. When it's over, you feel good. You're like, let's do it again. Let's have it. Bring back the tube. Let's do it again. That's how good it feels. The one kind of downside for me personally was, and this, you can avoid this, I guess, is that as they were putting me under in the procedure room, they have a sound system playing music, which I think was supposed to soothe the patient, you know, and it would have, except for that as Dr. Sable was approaching me with the implement and the guy was turning on the wonderful drugs into my vein, at that instant, just as I was going under, the song that came over the PA system was Dancing Queen.
Oh, now, don't say anything bad about ABBA.
I would never say anything bad about ABBA. I'm only going to say that that's really not the last thing you want to hear ringing in your ears as a man is approaching you in a fairly vulnerable position with a tube. That's all I want to say about that. The other thing is the preparation for the colonoscopy. I don't want to get too explicit here, but they have to clean you out. And so they give you a nuclear laxative so powerful that your bowels travel into the future and you expel food you have not even eaten yet. Okay. So you have to be ready for that. But other than that, it's a great thing. I recommend it to everyone.
Okay. Moving on. a young reader asked me to ask you, how did you get the idea for Peter and the Starcatchers? And I personally wanted to know if you just love Peter Pan, you had a thing for Mary Martin, or perhaps it was something about green tights. Explain.
Well, first of all, to take those in reverse order, I never liked, even as a kid, I always liked Peter Pan. I never liked the Mary Martin thing. I mean, when I was that play, that was big on Broadway. Or no, I guess it was a TV show made for TV.
Yes.
When I was a kid, and I hated that this middle-aged woman was running around pretending to be a—I mean, like, are they stupid? You know, like my image of Peter Pan was this—you know—this flying boy, and this was a middle-aged woman hanging from a wire. So that I never liked, but I loved the Peter Pan story. But it never would have occurred to me ever to get involved directly, personally, with the Peter Pan story as an author. Except for I belong to a band of authors called the Rock Bottom Remainders, and a lot of great authors in the band, but the bass player is a fellow named Ridley Pearson, who is a terrific thriller writer and also a parent. And he was in Miami for the Miami Book Fair and staying at my house. The band was going to play, and we're having breakfast, and Ridley said, this, I don't know, 7-8 years ago, he said, I was reading Peter Pan to Paige. Paige is his daughter. His daughters are named Paige and Story, if you can imagine.
Oh, good.
Yeah. And yet the authorities do nothing. But he was reading reading Peter Pan to Paige, and she asked him, how did Peter Pan meet Captain Hook? And he thought about that, and he and I started talking about that at breakfast. Like, that is kind of weird, you know, like the story just begins. There's a flying boy on an island, and there's pirates, and there's mermaids, and there's Tinkerbell, and it never grows old. And so, he said, I was thinking of trying to do a prequel to that. And I said, wow, you know, that's really kind of a cool idea. I never would have thought of that, but that'd be an interesting thing to try. And he goes, well, you want to do it with me? Because I've never written for kids. And I thought, well, I've never written for kids either. But that sounded like a fun thing to do. So that really we thought we were going to write just I thought maybe it would be 100 pages, if that, kids book. And we sat down and started plotting it and working on it, and it ended up being a 500-page book, kind of young adult, really, kind of Harry Potter level reading rather than real little kids. And Disney bought it, and became a bestseller. It did really well. And we had a really great time writing it and going above all, going out and promoting it, because we had never dealt with kid readers before. I mean, neither one of us would ever want children exposed to the work we've been doing up to that point. And they were just the best readers there are.
All right. So my daughter, Haley, begged me to ask you this question. In the past, you've made many creative recommendations for would be a good name for a rock band, including the Flemtones, the Bones of Contention, and Groping for Elmo. So have you coined any new ones, and what are some of your favorites?
Oh, man. You know, I always get this question, and it's really hard to remember, because I use so many of them particularly when I blog, and I can never remember any of them when people ask me what they are.
Okay. I'll tell her.
Wait, I can look them up.
No.
But that'd be basically going on the internet and looking up. But basically, okay, here's a couple that I've had over the years that I kind of like. Weasel Nostrils, The Flaming Croutons, Shark Puke.
Okay, thank you. And Haley, thanks to you too. And Dave, what's next for you? What are you working on now?
Well, I'm kind of in between. I just finished this fifth book with Ridley in the Starcatchers group, and I'm starting a novel which I haven't written it just on my own novel in a while. So I'm starting one that'll be set in South Florida, and I don't want to go too much into the plot because I'm still working on it, but it does involve a wedding. I find weddings to be very funny. My son got married a little over a year ago, and it's one of those things where everybody knows what's going to happen with the wedding. Everybody knows, first of all, the bride is going to go clinically insane. The mom of the bride is also going to go clinically insane. There's going to be a wedding planner who you can't believe how obnoxious this person is. Everything's going to cost way more than you think, that anybody thinks. Everybody knows all those things, and yet they're all going to come true. It never lets you down. Weddings are very consistent in that respect. So I've always found weddings to be funny, and I wanted to build a novel around one. So I came up with an idea for a plot set in South Florida involving a wedding, so I'm going to do that.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Dave. Readers, I'll mature when I'm dead. You have to pick it up. We previewed it on an earlier show, and you're just going to love it. Thanks, Dave.
Elaine, I love your show. Thanks for having me on, and I owe all my success to you personally.
Okay. Bye.
All right. Take care.
Bye. Readers, we've already previewed Dave's most recent title, I'll Mature When I'm Dead. But I thought, since it's only January, you'd like to listen to another Dave title, History of the Millennium So Far, a collection of his wildly popular year-in-review columns. Dave took a long, hard look at our millennium, and when he stopped hyperventilating, he wrote it all down, because nobody would believe it otherwise. In November 2000, the skies darken over Florida as hundreds of thousands of lawyers parachute into the state from bombers. While, in 2002, the federal budget surplus disappears. In April 2003, no weapons of mass destruction had been found, but investigators do discover three barrels of lard, described by U.S. intelligence analysts as a heart attack waiting to happen. In 2004, an already troubled nation receives an even greater blow, the sight of Janet Jackson's exposed nipple. And on we go.
This kind of story is my bread and butter. I let the other columnists deal with the hard news. The exception is the year in review. This is my one effort to participate as a journalist in the writing of the first rough draft of history. Each year, along about Halloween, I start going through the headlines month by month, summarizing the big stories that happened during that year. My deadline to finish the year in review is always early December, so I have to make most of December up. But that's not a big concern, as I also make up large chunks of the rest of the year. The book you hold in your hands contains my reviews of all the years of the second millennium so far. As a bonus, this book also includes my review of the first millennium, covering the years 1000 through 1999. I realize that there are people who will argue convincingly that, technically, the second millennium did not end until the end of the year 2000. To those people, I say, in all sincerity, shut up. These two millenniums have not been picnics for the human race. But as you read this book and review the many tragedies that have befallen humanity over the years, I suspect that you'll come to the same surprising conclusion that I did. No matter what challenges we face as a species, no matter what hurdles are placed in our way, somehow we always find a way, even in the darkest hour, to make things worse. It's a miracle, really. You read about the events of one year and you think, there is no possible way that human beings can get any stupider than that. Then you read about what we did the next year and darned if we didn't pull it off. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed the book. I could not have done it alone. I would like to thank the famous dead British historian, Arnold J. Toynbee. I've never read any of his books, but I like the way his name sounds. Toynbee, Toynbee, Toynbee. I would also like to thank Aretha Franklin for obvious reasons. Last but definitely not least, I thank the members of the Downingtown Area Regional Sewer Authority for all they have done and continue to do. Y1K. Dave Barry's complete history of the millennium, give or take 3 centuries. And so we stand together, the human race, plus the members of Limp Bizkit, poised on the brink of the year 2000. In a matter of days, we will find ourselves in a new millennium, facing exciting challenges and questions such as, why are we lying in a dumpster naked? And when did we get this highly personal Pokemon tattoo? But this is not the time to think about our New Year's Eve plans. This is the time to take one last lingering look back at the millennium that is drawing to a close. For as the ancient Greek historian Thucydides often said, when he was alive, history is a bunch of things that happened in the past. His point was that human civilization is a journey, and only by retracing the steps of that journey can we truly come to know, as a species, where we lost our keys. And so let us now press the rewind button on the VCR of time. Let us travel back together, back 1,000 years, back to January 1, 1000. This was the historic day that humanity celebrated the dawn of our current millennium. The occasion was marked by feasting, dancing, and the public beheading of a whiny, tedious group of people who would not stop insisting that, technically, the new millennium did not begin until January 1, 1001. But it was not all fun and games back in those days. It was a world of ignorance and fear, a world of pestilence and famine, a world of extremely high BO levels. Also, there was the Y1K problem, an unforeseen manufacturing glitch that caused parchment to malfunction such that many words were turned inside out. Otto, for example, became toot. Fortunately, back then almost nobody could read, so most people were able to continue doing their jobs under the popular economic system of the time, feudalism, which is sometimes called the Internet of the Middle Ages. Feudalism was based on a ladder type of organizational structure similar to Amway. You started out on the bottom rung, in the position of serf. This was not an easy job, but if you worked hard, followed the rules, did not complain, and were a team player, after a certain period of time, you fell off the bottom rung and died. This system freed the people higher up on the ladder to form noble families and create new empires, which began ebbing and flowing all over the place. In the words of the great British historian Thomas Carlyle, like moon pies on a hot sidewalk. In Asia, the Chinese had just invented gunpowder, which would have made them the strongest military power in the world, except that they had not yet invented guns.
Readers, how did you like genre jumping? I think it is the perfect exercise for bibliophiles like us. Readers, I'm excited to share some show news with you. Our website, www.bookreportradio.com, is up and running. Check it out if you'd like some more information on the books we've previewed or want to check out others we've discussed in the past. Again, the website is www.bookreportradio.com. I'm Elaine Charles, and I'm so glad you went the distance. See you next week on The Book Report.